Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist. I hope you enjoyed my new cheesy intro. My name's Ethan, and I'd like to welcome actress, author, and founder at Dare to Doubt, Alice Gretchen. Alice, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing so well, Ethan. Thank you. How are you?
Good. Thanks for doing this. Recovering from religion excursion, to which you gave a speech on DMT, which... Awesome. I've been wanting to talk about that for quite some time, so I'm excited that at some point in this interview, we will dive into that. In the meantime, if you could, just give a brief background about yourself.
So brief background about myself. I was born in the Bay Area to Christian parents. They at the time belonged to the Foursquare Gospel denomination, which for anyone who doesn't know is very Pentecostal and Holy Spirit driven. And then my parents were missionaries briefly in Asia when I was a toddler, settled in Rockford, Illinois, which is where I think of myself as having grown up because that's where I spent the major formative years of my early childhood. So that's where most of my childhood memories are. My family got involved in a revival movement called the Toronto Blessing that really took our faith and life in a very nomadic direction, we'll just say, for the nutshell version. And when I was almost 17, I moved out by myself to LA to be an actor, and I'm still here.
Awesome. So you grew up only about 2 hours from where I live.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yes. Yeah. No, I love Chicago. I had an aunt who lived in Chicago for a little while, and I loved coming to visit her. And like Chicago deep dish pizza is still my favorite, although I have to say, Detroit style pizza is giving it a run for its money. I've lately been getting into Detroit style pizza and it's so good.
Wait, what is Detroit style pizza? This is new to me.
Okay. You have got to have some ASAP and good luck in Chicago, which prides itself on its pizza. But yeah. Might maybe just drive a few hours north and east.
Hey, it's worth it if it's good pizza.
So Detroit style pizza, when I've had it the legit way that I've heard had it, and my boyfriend grew up near Detroit and he says this is the legit way, it's square, almost like a Sicilian style pizza. Okay. But it's thinner, not a thin crust. It's still very much a deep dish pie. And unlike Chicago style, which usually has the tomato sauce on top, depending on where you go, I know we're getting into very dangerous territory here, Detroit style is like normal pizza where it's just cheese and toppings on top and tomato sauce is tucked neatly underneath. But what I really love about it is the crust is very flaky. There's like a flakiness to it, whereas the Chicago style deep dish crust feels more bread-like, if that makes sense.
Yes, I love flaky crust.
You're going to like Detroit style pizza, I'm telling you.
I am going to have to try this now. Hopefully I can find somewhere in Chicago, Detroit style pizza.
You might be able to. So the best Detroit style pizza that I have ever had, and I have not yet had it in Detroit, so no one hate me. But the best that I've ever had was actually in Austin, Texas at this place called Via 313, which is the area code for Detroit. And it's like, my mouth just watered right now thinking about it.
Will you be at Faithless Forum? Because that's the next time I'll be in Austin, Texas.
You know, maybe. I can't make it out next month. Are you talking about the one that's next month?
Yeah.
November 19th. I'm happily engaged with baby shower duties. So I can't, not for me, for one of my best friends.
Oh,
so,
okay. I was about to say congratulations.
But yeah, no congratulations due my way. But no, two of my best friends are having a baby and I'm co-hosting their baby shower. So I'll be doing that.
Well, I suppose that's a decent excuse to miss Faithless Forum.
Yes, but one day, I would love to.
Well, your resume is quite impressive. You started college a week before your 16th birthday. Am I getting that right?
Just about, yeah. It was. Let's see, the spring semester of college started like mid-January. I started in spring semester, which is just weird. My birthday is in early February, so it was like a week or two before I turned 16. So technically, I was like 15 in college. Am I getting that right? Yeah. Gosh, that was a long time ago.
And before we get into why you're an atheist, if you could, what was homeschooling like for you?
So homeschooling, for anyone who doesn't know, I was homeschooled my entire life until I went to community college. And I actually really loved it. And caveat here, I know a lot of people had a really terrible and abusive homeschooling experience, or a very neglectful one. Both of my parents happened to be college educated, and very smart, well-spoken, well-written, like very learned people. They met at UC Berkeley. So they're like smarty pants. And my mom is just naturally a really good teacher who genuinely loves teaching. I'm the oldest of five kids, and she homeschooled all of us, except for my youngest sister, who went to high school for, I think, 2 years. But she was the only one of us who ever really did the public school thing. I loved being homeschooled, mainly because I got to set my own hours and my own time pretty much from age 12 on. And so, like, I hated math. Like, math was always a subject I was worst at, and I hated it. And so what I would do is I would do my week's worth of math on Monday. I would batch binge my subjects. That way I wouldn't have to do math the rest of the week or think about it. So I loved having that kind of independence. And my mom was very lenient because I was just an uber conscientious kid, as many good little Christians are and were. And right. And also, you know, God might tell them if I cheated. And so my mom even let me grade myself. Like, she would let me take her teacher's key, which had all the answers, some of which were wrong, by the way. Fuck you, Abeka. And I like would it. And like, I would bring it to my dad when it said I would get something wrong. Not that I got everything right, mind you, but like when I knew I got something right, I would bring it to my dad. He would do it with a calculator and be like, no, you're right. This book is wrong. So there were a few moments like that where it was like, that's frustrating. I would have enjoyed being in a classroom and having a teacher be a little bit more hands-on with helping me understand certain concepts or problem-solving things. I would say the biggest thing that I missed on being homeschooled, I always wanted to be a foreign exchange student. So I didn't get to do that. I got to do a mission trip, which is so not the same thing. but I wanted to be a foreign exchange student in Paris, France, because that was my dream. And I also really wanted to go to prom. Never got to go to a prom or a homecoming or anything like that. And honestly, even if really? I had school, my parents wouldn't have let me. There's no way they would have let me go to prom. Oh. They were pretty strict. So I as much as I did enjoy being homeschooled for some reasons, there were definitely times where I was like, I just want to be a normal kid, you know, and go to school and hang out with peers my own age. And I did do that in like youth group and stuff. There were definitely times that I wish I could go to school. But of course, in retrospect, I'm so grateful that my life panned out the way it did, because it's what allowed me to move out of the house pretty young and start a whole career in LA, where I got to walk red carpets, which is way cooler than prom.
Really, yeah, that's okay. That is really cool.
Yeah, like I'm a super girly girl. I love to dress up, and that's really all prom was about for me. It wasn't about the date or the corsage. Like, I just wanted to wear beautiful gowns. I still do.
So I've seen you describe your parents as very, very conservative and strict, but then in some other ways they'd be like more lenient, like letting you move to LA at a young age. Is that accurate? So
yes.
What are some of the areas where they're stricter versus areas they're more, you know, liberal on?
Yes. So nail on the head for asking the question of the conundrum and seemingly paradox that is my parents back then and to this day in many ways. We've all grown, evolved, and changed and all of that. But yeah, there's still a paradox that like is like, huh? But yeah, how to, huh?
Right.
I think the ways that they were strictest with me, to my immediate recollection when I was growing up, was with what I was allowed to watch, listen to, and where. I was the girl at the slumber party who had to object when everyone said like, oh, let's watch Sister Act 2, because I wasn't allowed to watch Sister Act 2. I wasn't allowed to watch Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion. I wasn't even allowed to watch Home Alone. I wasn't
or Jumanji,
allowed-
right?
Or Jumanji, couldn't watch Jumanji.
That was such a good movie though.
That's what I hear. Still haven't seen it.
Wait, you still haven't seen Jumanji?
Dude, I still haven't seen it. I didn't see Jurassic Park until a few years ago.
Okay, you have homework.
I do.
Homework.
You're allowed to recommend three movies. That's what I always tell people.
Sorry, you always, I didn't hear that. You tell people what?
You're allowed to give me three movie assignments as homework, is what I always tell people when they're like, wait, you haven't seen this, but you haven't seen this. It's like, okay, I have a very long list of homework. You're allowed to recommend three.
I'll just give one, Jumanji.
Okay, Jumanji.
It's not like the greatest movie ever, but it is a classic and it's definitely what I would recommend seeing.
Okay, I will watch that. There were some PG and even a few PG-13 movies my parents were okay with us watching, but it depended on the themes. Certainly if there's any nudity or sexual themes, hard no. But even like Home Alone, there was no nudity or really sexuality in that movie, but it encouraged rebelliousness. So my parents said we couldn't watch that because it might, I don't know, give us ideas of rebelling. I'm not sure, you know, and like music, I wasn't really allowed to listen to secular music, except for oldies. I was always allowed to listen to the oldies station and then like certain kids' songs and stuff. But yeah, I think, I don't know. So I think the ways that my parents were really liberal with me though, and liberal, I guess, is a relative term, as is conservative. For example, like me and my sisters were always allowed to wear pants. We could wear leggings, we could wear jeans, but some girls at the church that we went to in Illinois couldn't. They had to wear long skirts with leggings on underneath. So they were more traditional fundamentalist, I guess you could say. And okay. So, and some friends of ours like were, they converted to the Amish faith. And so like, I don't know, conservative was a very relative term when I was little. So in that sense, my parents were pretty easygoing. I wasn't allowed to wear two-piece swimsuits or like paint my nails a color. I could paint them clear, but I couldn't have color. I couldn't wear makeup until I was like 13. And then very incrementally, they allowed me to, it started with lipstick, but no eye makeup. I could wear lipstick. So I don't know, very incrementally. But then, okay. Yeah, when I was 16, I got invited to move out to LA for pilot season. Which is when a lot of TV networks are casting for new shows to hopefully be picked up to a full series. And my parents, they totally encouraged me to do it. And it's in large part because we thought it was a door God was opening. Most everything that I can remember in my upbringing was always done through the lens of, is this a door God's opening or is it a door God's shutting? That's like the shortest way I can put it. And like God opened a lot of doors and God shut a lot of doors. And so my parents, I moved around a lot starting from age 11. My parents believed that God was calling them to travel and be voluntarily unemployed. And we vagabonded around for a while. We didn't really have an official home. We lived in campgrounds and with people, some we knew, some we didn't. And then when I was 14, we started settling down again in Kansas City. So they were already very unconventional and adventurous. They always have been very adventurous people. But I think because of that sort of like independent, go against the grain, buck convention streak that's in each of them, despite their very strictness about other things, I think that's what makes them so interesting. Like my parents are nothing if not true to themselves. And they really don't care what other people think in the sense that it would sway what they would or wouldn't allow their kids to do or what they would or wouldn't encourage us to be. They always encouraged us to be ourselves. And I don't think they quite expected that being ourselves would take us in the directions that it did. Like, here I am, an atheist. I don't think they thought that would happen when they said that. But I still have a very close relationship with both of them. That's not to say it hasn't been rocky, but it's in certain patches. And you got to meet my mom, actually, because she came with me.
She seems very supportive and you two seem so close.
We are. And she is. She really is. She came with me to the Recovering from Religion fall excursion. And for the record, you know, my mom no longer identifies as Christian. I think she would more closely identify with something closer to like mystic or agnostic mystic. Like she's still very spiritual and in some ways, but she's kind of undefinable, my mom, and always open to to, she really respects authenticity and truth. So even when it's been painful for her, and not just with me, but with anyone she loves, I'm the oldest, like I said, I'm the oldest of five. So between me and my four younger siblings, we're all so different and so unique and so very much authentic. And I think that, I never take for granted how lucky I am to have parents that are like that, because there's so many kids who grew up religiously whose parents won't even talk to them anymore if they're not also religious. And that's so painful to even imagine. And I can't imagine how much more painful it must be for those who have extra strained or non-existent relationships with their parents and other family members too. I'm extremely lucky and grateful for that. Like I said, it hasn't always been easy, but what I appreciate and what has been consistent is my parents have always maintained an openness and willingness to talk. And I feel like you can't ask much more of people than that.
No, of course not. So did you by chance have a hand in your mother's, I guess I don't want to say full on deconstruction, but moving from, you know, very Christian over to mystic?
You know, probably yes and no. So I guess another little asterisk caveat to put in here, speaking about my mom specifically, as it turns out, even when she was a Christian, she wasn't quite a traditional Christian. In case no one's getting the picture yet, my parents are both very untraditional people, no matter what they're into. But like, for example, I didn't find out until I was getting ready to publish my book that my mom never believed in hell. And that to me was like the crux of Christianity. You believe in that Jesus is your savior so that you don't die for your own sins and be punished forever in hell. Why else would you believe in Jesus? Was my thinking. And there's a lot of people who don't believe in hell who believe in Jesus. And I respect that, you know, but it's, to me, that was just the bottom line of Christianity. It's like what makes you born again or a believer as opposed to a non-believer. And so to find out that my mom never even believed in hell, yet described a very intimate relationship with Jesus, was, you know, it to this day continues to baffle me a little bit, but back then we didn't talk about that. Like I had no clue about that my mom believed in basically an entirely different God and Jesus than I did. And certainly than most of the people around me did. We didn't talk about it for some reason. So I just assumed when my mom would use the words God and Jesus that she was talking about the same ones found in the Bible. And I don't know, it's interesting. Like my mom and I recently got into a debate over the biblical words of Jesus versus the subjective experience of Jesus. And so it's to me, when people use the word Jesus, I just assume they're talking about Jesus, the Christ of the Holy Bible, not a personal subjective Jesus that's maybe inspired by the Holy Bible, but has become something else, because words are symbols. And if we can't agree on the definition of words, what do they mean? But I just take things way too literally. And that's always been a problem for me, and probably why losing my faith was extra hard, and why it was harder for me in many ways to be a Christian, because I was just constantly confused. God to me meant confusion.
Same. I also have a problem with taking things too literally sometimes, or like dry humor always goes over my head all the time. It's just like, I take people seriously and I'm just like, what? I thought that's how you meant it. But for me, same. Jesus was always the most confusing thing to me. Like I remember asking my mom like who Jesus was, and she's telling me he's a son, but he's also God. And I'm like, wait, he is God or he's not God? Well, he's both. Well, wait, what? Like it just, it never added up for me.
And then he has the nerve to say what you mean and mean what you say, and like, let your yes be a yes and your no be a no. And he's the king of riddles. To me, he's not the king of kings. Jesus is the king of riddles, is how I think of him. Like the parables, I called them back then, but to me, they felt like riddles, because the stakes, when we're talking about heaven and hell, the stakes are so high for eternity that they're a loving Jesus and a loving God would leave no room for confusion. They wouldn't leave it up to you to figure out what they meant. That's just torture, psychological torture, and cruel, in my opinion. And I know that a lot of people love that. They love that it's open to what the spirit might lead you to interpret. They love that it's, you know, it's whatever it means to you. I don't like that. I think when we're talking about stakes this high, we need to have very black and white clarity.
Agreed. So you became an atheist, if I recall, when you were 21, is that correct?
Yes. Yes. You recall very well.
go through that, your deconstruction for me? Like, how did that happen, or what changed your mind?
I would say the turning point for me personally, so to back up, I was a very, very devout Christian. I took it, again, taking everything very seriously. I took it very seriously, even though God and Jesus were nothing but confusing to me. It was only confusing because I took it so earnestly. I really wanted to get it right. I wanted to do it right. I wanted to please God the way he wanted to be pleased. And I didn't date. I never held hands with a boy. I had a purity ring. I was saving myself for my future husband. All of the popular evangelical Christian courtship books, like I Kissed Dating Goodbye or Eric and Leslie Ludi's When God Writes Your Love Story. Like, I took all of these things to deep heart. And the promise for all of this fidelity to a future spouse and to God was that God was going to bless me with this epic, incredible romance. And, you know, I was a very romantic teenager. And so I thought, like, oh, man, this is going to be great. Of course, I'm going to give the pen of my love life over to God, because if my imagination is this good and God says he has something even better, duh, like, why wouldn't I trust God? And then cut to, I'm 17 years old. It's the first year I'm living on my own in Los Angeles. And a guy from my youth group back in Colorado, because that's where I moved to LA from, he also moved out here around that time. And he, one day out of the blue, we'd never dated. We were just friends. But one day out of the blue, he told me that God had shown him that I was his future wife. And so that stunned me beyond. And it's and I see the skepticism in your eyes right now. I'm like, come on, buddy. I was not skeptical. I immediately believed him because he was a guy I knew well, that I was very close to, that was from the same world that I was from. And I knew he would never say something like that lightly. And God never talked to me, because God's not real. And I felt like of course God would tell my future husband and not me. I don't know why I thought God was suddenly going to talk to me when it was time for my future spouse to be revealed, because God had never talked to me about anything. So it made sense too, because, you know, the woman is supposed to submit to the male headship. So I thought it was just the beginning of me learning how to submit to my husband. And I went along with it for a couple months.
You weren't into him, I'm assuming.
No, I cared for him very much as a friend, but I didn't have a crush on him. I wasn't into him that way. I didn't have feelings for him like that, even though he's a good looking dude who, like, you know, was a very dear friend of mine. It just wasn't, just not my type, I guess we could just say. Certainly not the future husband I built up in my head that God was going to, like, reveal one day. And I felt, what really cinched the deal though, and this is pretty textbook in all of the Christian courtship books that I had read by that point. What cinched the deal was when he called my dad to ask for my hand in marriage. My dad gave it and also said something along the lines of how he too had known that this was coming. And then when we called the guy's mom, she said that she had also heard from God that I was going to be her future daughter-in-law. So that's like triple confirmation. I don't know what more a Christian needs to know that this is the will of God, that I marry this guy who was 3 years older than me. He was 20, I was 17. And I just felt like my life was set in stone, and I felt deeply betrayed, but mostly by God, because I felt like I'd done all the right things. I obeyed. I took the lessons that I'd read in the courtship books to heart, and I had faith that God was going to reward my faith with this epic romance. Right. And I felt like I was facing an arranged marriage.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, it was. And so that was the first thing that really shook my faith, because it was the first time that I felt like God betrayed me. And I was so scared to acknowledge that I felt betrayed by God, because God doesn't betray people. He doesn't trick people, allegedly, even though the biblical God certainly does. But, you know, the church God, the many churches that I went to, again, with the confusion, are we talking about the God of the Bible? Because I don't think we're talking about the same God. It was very, that was the beginning of my deconstruction. And of course, that word deconstruction, I don't even think that was a term in this sense back in, this was 2003. There were not online communities of deconstructionists or progressive Christians or atheists even. There were probably some atheist online communities, but there was not the plethora of resources for people doubting or leaving their faith that there are today.
No, definitely not.
No. And so like, it was just, That I would say I can trace now and say, yes, that was the beginning of my deconstruction. But back then it just felt like hell on earth.
It sounds just, that feels like a trap.
That is, it's how it felt. I felt very trapped. That's the exact word I used in my journals, which I had to reread when I was writing my memoir. And it was awful getting through those journals, just remembering how heartbroken and depressed and devastated I felt. And breaking it off was like the hardest thing and the scariest thing that to this day I've ever done, because it was the first time that I consciously, deliberately disobeyed God. I broke off this betrothal, this engagement that God had appeared to divinely appoint. And I felt like basically I was saying like, Satan, I'm yours. Ruin me, destroy me now, drag me to hell, because I've now left the umbrella of God's protection with my overt disobedience. And that ties into free will, which is also confusing, because it's like, okay, God gives us free will. We don't have to do everything he asks of us. Okay, but again, when the consequence is the possibility of an eternity in flames, like, I just don't see the free will there. So it just never made sense to me. And plus, God already knows what I'm going to do, since he's omniscient, knows everything. So there's no such thing as free will, period, the end, in that mind frame for me. Again, I know other people see it differently. This is just how it was for me. So yeah, that was the beginning. And then at 21, I would say I was a progressive Christian from age 17 to 21. Again, didn't even use that term, never heard of the term then. But now that's kind of, looking back, I feel like that label would have applied. I still believed in God. I still believed in Jesus. I never imagined I would lose my faith completely. I was so scared of hell. I just really thought that like, I just needed to redefine God and remodel my idea of God based on cherry-picked Bible verses, not the whole thing, which I had indeed read. I was really trying to make God real to me. And eventually I couldn't anymore. And I didn't want to waste my life trying to believe in God anymore, because I felt, and so I gave him a test.
What was the test?
So the test, it always sounds dumb to me to say out loud, but it's the truth. One day I was washing dishes at my kitchen sink. And there was a spice rack on my wall. And I'd been agonizing over God's existence for weeks now, because I'd tried to watch the movie Jesus Camp, the documentary Jesus Camp, which was extremely, it's a good one. Okay. It's a good one. But I couldn't finish it back then. It's a documentary basically about an evangelical children's ministry summer camp. And it was so triggering to me. And I wouldn't have even known the word triggering then, but I could not watch even 10 minutes of it. And it just haunted me. I couldn't shake it. I was like, is everyone faking it? Like the way, cause I faked it. I faked the Holy Spirit, my whole upbringing. I would pretend to be slain by the Spirit, and I would fake praying in tongues. I would fake falling to the floor and shaking.
Really?
Receiving. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
That was my first acting job. Yeah. I pretended, because if you didn't fall over, either they would push you, like force you to fall. And that really hurt my neck one time when I was like about 10 years old. And this guy like pushed me on the stairs and forced me to fall down because I wasn't doing it. The spirit really wasn't doing it. It's super fucked up. Yeah. It's abusive. So I learned, you know, if I didn't pretend to, I would either be forced to be fallen over, or everyone would know there was something defective with me, that God was deliberately leaving me out. And they might think it's because there's some terrible sin in my life, and it might, you know, attract nosy, prying questions. And so I just pretended to. And this documentary, Jesus Camp, showed a bunch of other kids like praying in tongues and, you know, crying with their hands raised and like having like a slain by the spirit sort of moment. And it just brought back all of that pain of feeling left out by God, all of the fear of hell, all of the questions of like, what the fuck was actually going on in those churches? You know, like, I don't think everyone was faking it. And so I just needed to know. So I'm washing dishes at my sink and there's a spice rack, and I just know that this is what my test for God has to be. And I pray in my heart, and I'm like, God, if you're real, you have to knock over that jar of cinnamon. because I couldn't ask for a vague sign, because I thought like, oh, a gust of wind will blow, and I'll trick myself into thinking that that's God saying, yes, I'm here, I'm with you. Right. I didn't want God to decide how he was going to prove his existence to me, because anything could happen. And we, you know, our pattern seeking brains might try to construe it as proof of God. I was like, no, this, your existence has to be proven on my terms. And if you really love me, if you're really there, if you really care about whether or not I believe in you, you're going to knock over that jar of cinnamon. Didn't think it was too much to ask. He like
has no, that's pretty simple.
Sea. He's turned people into pillars of salt. He's turned staffs into snakes. Like, he's done a lot to prove his existence. So I'm like, it's just a little bottle of McCormick, just goes that. I would have probably been devoted for life. But nothing, of course, nothing happened. Over 30 minutes passed. And it was just the weirdest sensation, in that there was like an absence of sensation in the realizing, shit, like, God's not there. I'm talking to no one. I'm talking to like an imaginary friend just vanished. And it was just like the weirdest feeling. It's so hard to put into words unless you've gone through it yourself, of what that moment, and maybe for some people it's not so much a big moment as it is a slow chipping away. But for me, it was both. There was the chipping away, but then there was also that moment of like, wow, like, what do I even do with myself now? What's the point of life? What is that? Like, I don't know. I just kind of went about my day, and it didn't really hit me emotionally until, I would say, like about a week later. I caught myself praying on autopilot, and I just like stopped mid-sentence, and I was just like, there's no one listening. And then the grief came, of just like grief for a life wasted, grief for myself, grief for the God that I really believed loved me unconditionally and was protecting me at all times. Like, I felt so alone and so scared and so overwhelmed, so meaningless, worthless. That was rough, but there was also freedom, because it was like, if God's not real, neither is Satan. So I can do whatever I want. I never wanted to do anything that hurt anyone. I feel very lucky to be a person that doesn't get enjoyment out of hurting others. Most of us are like that. We don't get enjoyment out of hurting others. Every now and then there's some that aren't, or maybe in little moments we enjoy getting a good dig in. But so it's not to say that I went hog wild and became like, you know, a selfish asshole. I just wore what I wanted. I listened to music that I wanted. I went dancing. I got high. You know, like I just lived.
That's awesome. We have a question from Amit Matthew. Thanks for Super Chat. I imagine that there are plenty of atheist actors. Why do you think that so few are open about their atheism? And do you think that being an atheist has impacted your acting career?
So I do think, I'm going to answer the second part of that question first. And thank you for that question. I don't necessarily think it's impacted my career that much, largely because I only came out as an atheist 2.5 years ago. And in that past 2.5 years, half that time, I wasn't even an auditioning actor. Like, I'd taken some time off to finish my book. So, and also in the past 2.5 years, a lot's changed. Even in the past 5 or so years, I'd say a lot's changed in the industry. that, long story short, has resulted in me not booking work for a minute. A lot of it has to do with diversity casting, with my own mental health that I had gone through periods of dealing with. Sometimes my auditions just plain suck and someone else just does it better. I've just begun to audition again as of this year, which is still very slow because coming out of COVID, a lot of things are, they're just different now for everyone in most industries, I imagine. So there's a lot of that. So I can't really say how much atheism, being an out atheist, has impacted my career. Okay. However, I will say that, in regards to the first part of the question, why do I think that there are so many closeted atheists in Hollywood? Because there are. I think it's because it very much could and likely would impact their careers. Because you don't want to alienate your fan base. If you as an actor, if you're a team of producers looking to cast a film, and you obviously want as many people to want to watch it as you can, so you can make your money back that you're investing into the making of this film, why would you hire an atheist actor who's open about their atheism when over 70% of the United States, and I don't know a hard stat on the rest of the world right now, but Christianity and Islam are the two biggest religions worldwide, I can tell you that. Why would you want, if you're a producer of a film, why would you want to hire an actor who's an open atheist when... Right. Christians like myself were taught that atheists were being used by Satan to derail the faithful, not to support them. You'd be supporting Satan. Why would you hire an atheist actor? So to me, especially knowing the type of American Christianity that I grew up in a lot of different places in the country, it wasn't like I just went to one church, one denomination, hometown my whole life. I traveled quite a bit over the states and belonged to quite a few different churches who had varying levels of evangelicalism, I guess one might call it. But yeah, in all of them, what they would all have in common is atheists. Like, oh my God, you are either a project to be saved or you're just a tool being used by Satan. And you're not, that doesn't make you a very bookable thing. You're not going to have that. Not many Christians are going to follow an open atheist on social media. And follower count, unfortunately, does matter in the casting process for many actors. And I'm not talking about big A-list actors. There's a few A-list actors who have been open about their atheism, like Julianne Moore, for instance. She gets offers. I highly doubt she's still in an auditioning stage of life. So people really love her work as an actress. But I'm talking about auditioning actors, who don't have the privilege yet of just having offers to choose from left and right. It makes you more of a risk, and follower count matters. If you don't have a certain amount of social media followers, sometimes you can't even get into the casting office.
Really?
So, yeah. Like there's one network that I would have gotten to audition for, but at the time I didn't have enough followers. So, 'cause again, they want to make their money back. They want to hire actors who have a large fan base. So that is the lengthy way of saying why I, in my opinion, to my observation, many actors and other entertainers, including musicians, for example, may not be open about their atheism, even if they are, even if their close friends know they are. It's career suicide for some. Because you are going to lose an alien. I know I've lost a lot of my early fan base. When I came out, you know, like some of them hung in there with me for a little bit, but as I kept posting about some things, especially after I started Dare to Doubt, a resource site for people leaving faith, you know, I definitely got messages from people being like, oh, I've always been such a fan of your acting work, but I have to unfollow you now. You know, you've gone too far. It's just too far. And it's like, I get it. I could have seen myself saying the same thing. I totally get it. It's not personal. I understand that ideology. I understand that mindset. But there are some who have still hung in there with me, and cool, you know, like, thank you guys. you know, like I don't unfollow someone because I found out they're a super Christian. But you know, I also don't think they're trying to deter me on a path away from eternal life. So that's, again, the stakes aren't as high for me as it is for someone who's still a believer, I think.
That makes sense. If we could, I'd love to dive into mystical experiences. Because I have a few viewers, I should say one in particular, who is insistent that mystical experiences are messages from God. And if correct me if I'm wrong, but you believe these are all naturalistic explanations, correct? Like this, there's nothing supernatural to DMT or
Correct. I think what we don't know just hasn't been explained yet, you know, and I think it may be years before we understand. Because to me, when we talk about mystical experiences, what we're talking about is consciousness. What is consciousness? What is a mystical experience? What is a vision? What is a trance state? Well, what is a dream? You know, like what is consciousness? And so just because we don't yet fully understand what it is or what consciousness is capable of and all of its many possibilities, doesn't mean that there's not a naturally occurring explanation for it that could be found in empirical materialism. It just means we haven't developed the tools yet or asked the right questions yet. And I love that. I hold so much wonder for consciousness and awe for mystical experiences, soberly induced and non-soberly induced. But to me, it's not proof that there's something more. It's just proof that we don't know everything yet. Maybe we never will. But that doesn't make it magic. That doesn't make it supernatural. That doesn't make it proof of, you know, any existing belief system.
And I should have issued a trigger warning before we started talking about drugs. So here's your trigger warning now. We may be talking about drugs right now, so please feel free to turn off the broadcast if you are easily triggered by this material. What are your thoughts on DMT?
DMT, so AKA the spirit molecule. So my thoughts on DMT, I am so grateful for it because psychedelics like DMT, like LSD, like psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, these medicines, I'll just use the word medicines, these medicines are tools that allow people like me, for instance, who are unable to have a soberly induced mystical experience, to have one. I never got visions from God. When I was in church there praying and like pretending to fall over and speak in tongues, I never felt an overwhelming sense of love and connectedness until I did drugs. And I was like, oh, maybe this is what people were feeling. Maybe not. Maybe it's totally different. I wouldn't know the sober side because I think some people are just not wired to have them sober. Everyone has different neural hardwiring. And I think I'm just one of those people that are not easily able to have a soberly induced mystical experience. That's not to say I never could, it just has never happened in any way, shape, or form. But
Same.
everyone, regardless of your faith, regardless of your neural hardwiring, I highly doubt that if you take a hit of DMT or you take a tab of acid, that nothing's going to happen to you. You need no faith to have a mystical experience with the help of these little plant medicines. LSD, to be fair, is a pharmaceutical version of it, but psilocybin mushrooms, DMT, ayahuasca, peyote, these are naturally occurring substances here in the world. Animals do them too. We have receptors in our brains to be able to interact with these plants and these ingredients, these psychoactive ingredients. And so it's like, you know, I always encourage exploring responsibly and playing
Very
responsibly.
responsibly. And yeah, very responsibly. And anyone watching, please don't say either one of us is telling you to go out and try this. As you know, most of these substances are illegal. We're just having an open conversation with our opinions on it.
Exactly. And I would not recommend them to everyone. They can counteract very poorly with certain medications, with certain neurochemical makeups. So it is not, I do not recommend them to everyone. But I am grateful that there is something that is available to everyone that will allow them to experience what other people call God or the divine. Even as an atheist, you can experience some of this wonder and the sense of love and connectedness that spiritual people speak of. So that's DMT specifically. Now that's an interesting one. So LSD lasts typically 12 to 14 hours, psilocybin
Wait,
mushrooms.
you say 12 to 14 hours?
Yeah, you only peak on LSD for maybe around 6 hours-ish. You know, it's not like you're like tripping balls the entire time, but the effects of it are still in you. So yeah, that's a really long commitment. Some take days. Like, I don't quote me on this. I have not taken peyote, but I want to say peyote or mescaline is the one that you trip for like 3 days. I personally don't have an interest in that one.
That sounds actually kind of terrifying. I would not. I'm all for like having a little bit of fun for a little while, but yeah. I don't want to be inoperable for that long.
Yeah.
That extended period of time.
No. So DMT, 10 minutes. It's a very short commitment. And DMT is also supposedly, and I'm no expert, I'm not a biologist, I'm not a neuropsychologist or anything like this, but supposedly DMT is also what our brains release at birth and at death. And it makes sense. Like, very few of us remember being born. No one's actually died and come back to talk about it. Near-death experiences, we can put a pin in that, and I can come back to that in a minute if we want. But I'm talking dead, dead. Like, you're dead. There is no bringing you back. Like, you burned to death. You're gone. No, you actually fully died. We don't know what that was like for that person. From near-death experiences, though, there's a lot of parallels between what I've heard about near-death experiences and DMT trips. And it's my theory that their DMT sort of simulates a near-death experience in some ways. And I actually got to talk to one person who's had both. And he said He said it is similar. So I was like, if I were a researcher at college right now, this would be my life's passion work. Like, I would be doing clinical studies and like, I would be doing so much. So it's a blast off, basically. It's like all of these experiences, it's hard to describe with words, but it's because they're so personal and subjective. But what some broad generalities, by the way, DMT is also one of the active ingredients in ayahuasca, which a lot of people have heard. It's a South American shamanic tea.
Yeah. And they like, don't they, when you drink the tea, they guide you through this experience?
I think that's like, the traditional way of doing it. Yeah. Traditionally, a shaman would be there to guide you through the experience. And there's a lot of purging, AKA vomiting and shitting yourself.
Wait, seriously.
Yeah, so I have not done ayahuasca. I know many people who have, and most of them at some point purge, and that's looked at as a good thing because you're like, you know, if you look at it through a spiritual lens, you're releasing a lot of negative stuff. And if you look at it through just a biological lens, it's like, well, yeah, you're ingesting a poison, kind of, you know, like, so your body's reacting to it. DMT, to my knowledge, has not made anyone do that. So it's like a short condensed version of the blast off that ayahuasca might give somebody. But DMT's like all of these medicines we're talking about, everyone's going to have a very different experience. I only know mine, and it was a very positive experience. Not all of these are positive for people. And I think positive itself is a subjective term because I remember one time I had a stereotypically bad acid trip, but even at the peak of its scariness, and it was scary, I had the wherewithal to be able to tell myself, like, what can I learn from this? What can I learn from this? And it got better. I can't say that that'll make it better for everyone, but at the end of the day, even though people might call it a bad trip, I still feel like it's one of my favorite trips. Now looking back, so bad, good, you know, these things are going to be personal to everybody, right. But yeah.
I, to be blunt, I've been too scared to try DMT. Like, I would love to have that experience. But it's the scary part for me is like being like, hallucinating to that extent actually scares me. Like, I am kind of a freak when it comes to being in control of my mind. Like, I've never, like, I know a lot of people who have drank and they drank till they black out. I've never blacked out. Like, I've never in any way lost control of what's going on up here. So that makes me incredibly reserved with DMT. So I feel one day I may go ahead and try it. I'm on the cusp, but I'm not there yet.
That's totally understandable. I totally respect that, and respect that you respect yourself for that, because I think, you know, there's a lot of people that are like, oh, I was scared to do it. Just do it. Just do it. You know, and some people do it and they're like, oh, I don't know what I was so scared of. I just had the time of my life. Like, wow. You know, like, and then other people, like, I don't know. I think it's, they may not have such a good time and they may not feel ready for it. And so I think it's very important if you are going to dabble or experiment with any mind altering substance. Yeah, definitely do it on your terms and your timing, if and when at all. I don't think that everyone has to. I do think, as just someone who's experienced it, it's like falling in love. You know, maybe not everyone will fall in love in their lifetime. You can't really describe what it's like until it happens to you. You have ideas about it. You believe it happens to other people. But until you experience it yourself, like, how do you describe the experience of falling in love? And do you even want to? Because then there's breakups, you know, like, it's scary. You lose control. You surrender yourself to someone else when you admit that you're in love.
I do. I agree. My partner now told me she loved me first. And I felt the same, but I couldn't bring myself to say it. I was like, I can't be that in my head. I'm like, I can't be that vulnerable. And she literally said it. And I'm sitting there freaking out internally, refusing to say it. And I left her hanging for a couple of days. Total, like, felt like a jerk about it. I should have just said it because I felt it. But I was like, I can't be that vulnerable. This is scary. Yeah.
Well, it's a surrender. It's a loss of control, just like what you're talking about. No, and I totally relate to that. So I couldn't tell my first boyfriend. We dated for like almost a year before I was able to tell him that I loved him. He told me, but I was like, I can't say that to you. And it was partly because of that arranged betrothal that I was in. I told that guy that I loved him too when he said he loved me, and I didn't mean it in the way that he meant it. And I never wanted to say it again and not mean it. And so I just really held on to it. And then it became this big thing in my mind when I finally said it. But yeah, I totally relate to that. It is very vulnerable.
It is. It makes you feel very like, crap, I could really get hurt. Because I, truth be told, this is the first time I've ever been in love. And I have loved somebody before. In fact, I was actually married and in a committed relationship for 12 years, but wow. I was never, admittedly, even in this relationship, I would have said the same thing. I was never in love. I loved her as a best friend. And because of societal pressures and the way our relationship was, I thought I was just supposed to continue taking these steps in moving the relationship forward, especially because at times I was told, you know, I was being immature and real relationships move at this pace. So I'm like, okay, you know, I am pretty immature sometimes. I guess I need to keep going through the motions. And I went through the motions all the way to the altar, got married and stayed married for like 6 years until finally it was like, okay, neither of you are happy. Like, it's time to move on with your life, man. So for me, the first time I said I love you to someone I was actually in love with, it was like, holy shit, this is scary.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. No, I've fallen in love twice now. And it was terrifying each time. I very much relate to that. I do think falling in love is also very much like, I guess, tying it back to psychedelics, like there is a neurochemical similarity to them, to certain ones, I guess, that I can understand now having had experienced both, but again, hard to put in words.
That's what right now I'm trying to actually find the words to describe what falling in love is like. And I have no idea how to describe it.
It's, I
don't know. it's makes you feel vulnerable. It's amazing. It's scary. It's
terrifying.
Yeah, it's absolutely
terrifying. You feel like a crazy person. You can't get your thoughts straight. You jumble your words. You feel just possessed.
Like yes, all goo-goo gaga over the person.
Yeah, all goo-goo gaga. Can't think about, can't focus on anything else for anything. Like, nope. I forget
to
eat.
So butterflies. Yeah, you get butterflies in your stomach and you're like, oh my God, I don't want to say anything stupid. Like, it's, you feel like a kid is the best way. There, you feel like a kid.
You feel like a kid. Yeah, totally. But a kid who can have sex. So that's even more
Yes.
crazy.
And you know, I will say this, like, not to go into too much detail, but this is the first time I've had like a, what's the best way to, a positive sexually active, the first time I'm actually sexually active in a long time, because my last relationship was not healthy. And she is all about sex positivity, which is a whole new world for me, because I came from that shameful background where, you know, sex is wrong. Sex is just between a man and a woman. Sex is this. You're not supposed to talk about sex. And she is completely open with all her, you know, friends. They talk about everything. And it was so intimidating at first. But it's like a whole new world. Like, I don't have to be ashamed to talk about sex or to talk about what I enjoy about sex. Like, there's no reason to be.
No, it is an entirely different world and realm of human experience when you're with a partner who loves sex, and loves your body and like loves their body, you know, and like loves to share it. And like it's such a different experience.
It is.
Yeah, I love
Like,
it.
I was raised totally, you know, monogamous, and other things were frowned upon. And now where, I guess you would say that people say monogamish or non-monogamous, we're not poly, we're not even necessarily, we're not open either. And I'm not going to go into detail, but we're just not monogamous, which I could have never imagined years ago. Like, some of the things I do now, old me would frown upon.
No, I feel I could relate to that. Like right now, my partner and I are monogamous, but we're both open to the idea of non-monogamy at some point. Like it's on the table to be open to discussion. You know, it's not like a taboo. If one of us was like, you know, like I wouldn't be scared to bring it up if I wanted to, and I hope he wouldn't either. You know, like that is an interesting the whole like so deconstructing monogamy is like an entirely different thing. Someone on Instagram, I feel bad, I can't remember who, or I would shout them out, posted a question about like, have you deconstructed monogamy? Was that a part of your religious deconstruction? It's like, oh, well put, you know, like I did, but I didn't correlate the two, religious deconstruction and monogamy deconstruction. And they're very much related to me. I know a lot of people grow up in a secular America who weren't raised religiously at all, who still monogamy is just the default. You know, it's still very common in our culture, but it's for me, like they were definitely intertwined because after that very sad experience where I thought I was gonna have to marry a man I didn't love, I thought I would never get married. The idea of marriage was just so toxic and poisoned to me. I was like, no, fuck marriage, religious or not, it's like a patriarchal institution that I have no interest in. Now I just look at it like a business exchange, like which is kind of old-fashioned. You know, marriage always was a business exchange until the last 200 years or so. You know, there have been exceptions, I'm sure, of people who married for love, but it's like I feel like I could get legally married now, wholeheartedly, with a prenup in place, and I think that's incredibly romantic because it acknowledges I'm going to change, you're going to change. And we intend to change compatibly, but we both acknowledge that we may not. And so we're gonna like break up now from a loving place and or at least plan for that possibility to happen and hope it doesn't. So that's how I look at it now.
Well, my only advice to like anyone watching is, if you are considering non-monogamy, it requires pristine communication. You have to be completely open and honest about everything. Don't try and hide anything. Just be very, very clear in what you want. Question from theoretically, which
Ooh,
acting
clever.
method have you studied?
So I've studied several. I don't know if I could say that the one that I like is necessarily one specific method, but I really enjoy the acting studio that I go to here in LA sometimes when I am in class, is basically the West Coast version of Susan Batson Studio in New York City. Susan Batson uses a lot of sensory work in her acting techniques. That's always been the most effective for me. For anyone who's listening and is curious and doesn't know, sensory work is basically Like, say you have a scene that requires you to break up with your fake partner. You could just draw from real life and think of a time that you had to break up with an ex-lover, but maybe you never have, or maybe you were on the receiving end and you don't know what it's like to have to do the breaking up. You could maybe substitute, think of a specific time in your life when you had to tell someone something that they didn't want to hear, or a time in your life when you feared you were going to lose it all. It doesn't have to be literal to the scene. And basically with the sensory work, what you do then is you relive that scene. You picture everything around you. What did it smell like? What were you wearing? What did it feel like? For me, it places me so much in my body. There's no acting required. Like, your tone of voice changes, your movement changes when you're sensorially engaged in that memory, and then you bring that to the scene. So whatever method that is, I guess sensory work is maybe the most embodying method, but that's my favorite method of choice. And it's just the one that feels most authentic to me. It brings me there the quickest. It feels the most truthful. In my experience, a lot of times, that truthful acting, you know, it's a bit of a mind fuck, because we're taught in class that acting is you need to be truthful with your emotions. Like, did that ring true? Is the performance seem truthful? Not believable, but truthful. Is it coming from a place of truth? In my experience, what I found, especially in television, they want you to act. They don't want truth. It feels a lot like puppetry. Stick to the script, you stick to the written emotions. There's not really a whole lot of room always for authentic things. It's like, I might be feeling angry and expressing it differently than the director or writer had in mind. And they're like, no, we want you to perform, act angry the way we imagine angry, instead of me performing from a place of truth of, no, this is how I am right now when I'm angry. Doesn't look the way they thought it would, maybe. So I think that sometimes acting really is just acting. It's mimicry. Other times, at its best, I think it's revealing a truth.
The extent of my acting chops would be, I was an extra. Have you ever seen Prison Break?
No, I haven't.
Okay, it's a great show. It started out as a great show. I was in the pilot episode, just a background character a few times, which was pretty cool. But, you know, I don't think walking past the camera is really acting. So I have no experience in that area.
Dude, sometimes background actors have to act their faces off. They have to dance for hours on end to no music, because the principal actors are doing their dialogue and they're like shouting at each other as though there's music, but there's not. You're in a dead silent room shouting at each other like you would be at a nightclub, and all the background actors are dancing, trying to stay on the same beat. And like, background actors really have to fucking act.
I thought they had some type of music playing during those scenes. They don't?
No, usually not. Usually at the beginning of a take like that. And I never went to a real prom or homecoming, but I've played a lot of high school girls who have. So I've gone to a lot of fake proms and school dances and stuff like that. Usually what they do for those types of scenes is before the director calls action, they'll say playback, and they play a little clip of, like, I don't know, maybe 8 to 10 seconds of music. Like, say, some 50 Cent song, and just so everyone kind of knows the beat, and then they turn the music off and everyone has to keep going as though the music's still going. And then there's action, and then the dialogue begins. And as a talking actor, it is so painfully awkward to be shouting at your scene partner who's right there when it's a dead quiet room otherwise.
That's got to be really fucking awkward.
It's so awkward. So next time you guys are watching a show or a movie and there's like a really loud party scene, just know that there's no music playing. And that's, imagine what all those actors are doing. Because they have to capture the sound of the dialogue. It can't be cluttered with background music. They put that in post.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Now I would think that would be really comical to watch, especially seeing two people like yell at each other when there's nothing going on.
It's very comical. Same thing with like explosions. Like if in the finished product, there's like loud sounds happening, whether it's an action sequence, a dance sequence, whatever. Yeah, usually on a real set, it is crickets. So awkward.
My partner chimed in just a little bit ago, and she quoted, this is our toast, the one day we made. will be the last people we fall in love with, but not the last people we'll have sex with.
Oh, that is so beautiful. Well put. I love that.
Yeah, it was when she said that during our toast, I was like, I absolutely love that. That's perfect.
That's beautiful.
So before we get out of here, if you could, I wanted to touch on Dare to Doubt. Could you tell us a little bit about this? Because it is an excellent resource, and I think people should know more about it.
Thank you. So Dare to Doubt, it is a resource site. It's one that I run entirely myself. It's not for profit. Everything that I put into it, I just put into it of my own time and dime. And basically, I built the site that I wish I'd been able to find when I was 21 and lost my faith. Like I said, now there are a plethora of resources to help people at whatever stage of deconstruction they're at, whether it's like, I am still a Christian, but I don't want to be this type of Christian. There's got to be a gay affirming version of Christianity out there. Whether you're there or whether you're like, I never want to hear the word God again. I cannot stand spirituality. I don't even want to hear the word horoscope. I'm like hard averse to anything faith-based. I've endeavored to have resources on Dare to Doubt that can accommodate a smattering spectrum of different stages of doubt and non-belief. Because I'm, again, for me, there was that, you know, 4-year period where I was questioning and slowly losing my faith. And I think at that point, if I came across a hardcore atheist site, it would have scared me. And I would, it might've put me back into Christianity. And you know, I think I've tried to, that said, when I built Dare to Doubt, I did build it primarily for atheists because it's much harder, in my experience, to find non-spiritual evidence-based resources than it is to find ones that are spiritual. For example, therapy, trying to find a therapist in Los Angeles who's secular, for me was very hard. LA is a very spiritual place. It's not evangelical, like that would be very frowned upon culturally in the city of Los Angeles and in the Hollywood industry. But to be an atheist in Hollywood, which is very, the derogatory term, I guess, would be woo-woo. A lot of people here believe in astrology and crystals and, you know, it's looked at as very benign. To me, it's not, both theoretically and from my own personal experiences. And I think that I think a lot of people who are drawn to helping others in a therapeutic context are genuine people carers. And I, for some reason, that type tends, and I'm speaking very generally here, to be very spiritual. So even if they're not religious, they still might be spiritual. And so one of the very first resources I added on Dare to Doubt was the Secular Therapy Project. Because when I did lose my faith, I was in therapy for 3 years for what I now know to be religious trauma syndrome, panic attacks, self-harm, suicide, like the whole, I was a wreck for a while. Now I am so happy that I lost my faith.
You like glow. Your smile, your eyes, like you've got the, what do they call it when you squint, the crow's feet?
Yeah, whatever. A little smile.
Yeah, like you can see the genuine happiness radiating. Aww,
thank you. but yeah, I'm so happy now. And I'm here to tell you, if you're in that rough place, like it can get easier. I don't know your life. I can't promise you it'll get better. I feel sick when people say that's like, you don't know their life. You can't tell them it's going to get better, but it's gotten better for me and for so many people I know that I would encourage you to hang in there, get some psychological help if you can, go visit the Secular Therapy Project, find a secular therapist in your area who can help you process. There's a lot of therapists and resources for the deconstructing/progressive Christian or just the LGBTQ affirming Christian. There's a lot of resources for that. There are not very many resources for people who are like hard atheists that still want self-help or growth or meaning. You know, there's like not a lot of resources like that. If there are, many of them, and I love this personally, but I feel like there's a little bit of imbalance. Many of them are very the snarky humor kind. And I love those. I love atheist memes. I love making fun of the Bible now. I love
same. That. I don't do it publicly. But whenever I see them, I can't help but to laugh. I think because sometimes they make valid points.
Yeah.
I do sometimes think ridicule is important, but I don't personally use it. I want to be the friendly guy.
Yeah, no, I see it. Your friendly neighborhood atheist. Yeah, no, like I love that. I love that there is a growing corner of atheists who understand how scary sounding it is. And I find that the angriest atheists, the ones who are, you know, like the Christopher Hitchens, the Richard Dawkins, the Sam Harrises, to my knowledge, they were not raised super religiously. And I imagine it must be a lot easier to kind of like look down upon people who ever believed that to begin with, because it's so foreign to them. When you grew up in it, or it was all you knew and you did believe it, and then you find yourself an atheist, there's a lot of humble pie that goes with that, that makes it a little, maybe not for everyone, but for me, a little harder to really condescend and mockingly scorn. I'll laugh at it. I'll like it. I may even share it in a story, but it's not something that is in my natural lexicon of humor, I guess. I enjoy it as a consumer. This may change. You know, I've gotten a lot bolder lately. And I've, you know, if you catch me on a certain day, like, depending on my mood, claws could come out. I'm not above it.
I get that. There's times I'm feisty too, especially if I'm anxious. There's times like I'll start writing some or I'll go to share something and I'll have to be like, nope, you're just feisty right now. Don't do it.
I know. But then sometimes I do. And it like feels good and I feel bad later.
Yes, exactly. You feel so guilty, especially like if I get a message from one of my Christian like watchers or friends, I'm like, oh shit. I knew I shouldn't have shared that. Damn it.
I know. But at the same time, to me, my whole intention with Dare to Doubt and with pretty much everything else that I do in my life is to encourage living in your truth. And I feel like I would just be a total hypocrite if I encourage other people live in your truth without living in mine. So if I'm going to live in my truth, for me, that means I'm going to, not be afraid to share something if I really want to. Sometimes I just have the reflex to share something and I think of it and it's like, oh, I don't need to, you know, I don't need to share that to be true to myself. Other times it's like, I would feel like I would be going against my true self if I didn't say this, if I didn't share this.
I get that.
You know, so it's a very, it can change and fluctuate. And I just think that if we, you know, for some people they're where they're at in their true selves, like God still exists or always will. You know, and like, I respect that because again, I do think that everyone's neurowiring is a lot different. And some people are just more hardwired. They can't not believe in God if they tried, the way I can't believe in God if I tried, you know, I get. Same. So I, yeah. Oops, yeah. No, that's it.
Just, yeah. I mean, there are
choice.
Yeah. People who think it's a choice or have encouraged me, like, just get down on your knees and pray. Like I've prayed, oh no, you got to get down on your knees. You got to do this. It's like, I can't just get down on my knees and start pretending to pray something that I don't think is there. That's not how it works.
Yeah, no, 100%. And that's what I wasted 21 years of my life doing. I think that I always say, I don't think faith or faithlessness is a choice. What I do think is a choice for most of us who live in the Western world, who have access to information, whether from a public library or the internet, I'm not talking about like Islamic majority countries where you really are limited in what you can expose yourself to. I do think that for most of us in most places, we do have a choice over what we expose ourselves to, what books we allow ourselves to read, what documentaries we might allow ourselves to see. And so in that sense, I do think that we can take a sense of agency over, like, do I want to challenge my faith? Do I want to actually know, do I really believe in something? Or am I just scared that maybe I don't and something isn't real to me? I do think that most of us have a choice over what we're willing to expose ourselves to and the questions that we're willing to ask and the answers that we're willing to hear. But I think at the end of the day, an earnest God believer might watch all of the atheist documentaries, might listen to all the podcasts of why people lose their faith and still be like, I get why it's not real for them, but I just can't deny this is real to me. Mm-hmm. Live in that. That's beautiful. Have the courage to live in that. The opposite is true. You know, you may really want to be a believer. And like, it sounds like you, like me, really tried. We did all the things. we were lying to ourselves and therefore lying to everyone else around us. So I think lying to anyone, and especially to yourself, is just such a waste of time, such a waste of energy, such a waste of existence. People have to, again, like I said, I know I'm lucky to live in a country where I don't have to worry about being beheaded if I'm an open atheist, but I know not everyone has such a privilege.
No, so, we're very lucky to be able to be as outspoken as we are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you down. Thank you for sitting down with me. Is there anything you want to plug before we go?
Well, first, thank you for having me. This was such a joy. I was so delighted when you asked if I would be a guest in your podcast.
I'm glad you said yes.
Me too. The only thing to plug right now, I recently released the audiobook version of my memoir called Wayward. It is not on Audible right now. I may put it on there eventually. I released it through an audiobook platform called Soundwise, which let me put in a bunch of bonus material, like pictures that go along with my story. So if you're the kind of person that likes to read a memoir and loves when there's like pictures of the author's childhood or whatever in there, you can find this in digital files in the Soundwise audiobook program. So all you have to do is go to my website, alicegretchen.com/book. Or if you just go to my name, alicegretchen.com, you'll see it there on the homepage. And if audiobooks aren't your thing, you can also find it on Amazon in both paperback and ebook.
And I have all her links in the description. And then also would like to thank top tier patrons, Cindy Plaza, Left, Right, Left, Kenneth Leonard, Sky, Jump and Shoot, Oz, Secular Rarity, Philip Leach, Caitlin Beyond, Toast, Richard Gilliver, Sunset Sarge, Amit Matthew, Ray Sylvester, and Kyle Brewer. Thank you for your patronage. Alice, if you could just hang on 1 second, I'm going to close this out and I'll be right with you. Thanks, everyone. Like and subscribe.